Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. American journalist Jill Carroll is undergoing a medical evaluation and could leave Iraq today, following her release yesterday. What happened during the 3 months she was held hostage and why she was suddenly released are still a mystery. There are also questions about a new videotape that apparently was made shortly before her release. Carroll did speak briefly on Baghdad television yesterday, but on this new recording, presumably issued by her kidnappers, the previously unknown organization called the Revenge Brigades, Carroll denounces President Bush and praises the Mujahideen insurgents.
This is only a jihad to stop an illegal and dangerous and deadly occupation. So I think it's important people see the Mujahideen are people like we've seen it throughout history, resisting an occupation, trying to fight a foreign force in their land.
Joining us on the line from Cairo is Dan Murphy. He's Arab World Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and he's covering this story. He's a friend and colleague of Jill Carroll's. He helped work with the newspaper for her release. Dan, how did this video become available?
It was made available on a website frequented by jihadis and Iraqi insurgents, and you know, they release beheading videos in this place and all kinds of videos of attacks that they've made on Americans and so forth. And it spread from there, you know, all over the Internet.
Mm-hmm. And what does Jill Carroll say on the tape?
Well, she says a great many things. Essentially, she was told that the price of her freedom was making this video in which she would praise what they asked her to call the Mujahideen, the holy warriors, and criticize the United States. I'm not going to speak about what's on that tape. You know, it's a propaganda video made by the murderers of Alan and Wea and the people who subjected all of us, especially Jill and her family, to a horrific experience since January 7th. And I don't know why anybody would lend any credence to the sorts of things that people like that tried to coerce from Jill, who was their captive. These were people that held the power of life and death over her. They'd murdered her good friend and translator, Alan and Wea. And as everybody would have urged her to do, she complied with their wishes in return for her freedom because she hopes that people understand that, that speech made under duress isn't her speech.
Mm-hmm. But some things don't square in all of this. She is, understandably, described as being emotionally fragile. She was in a situation, a life or death situation. But she said at one point yesterday her captors did not threaten to hurt her, but they had said that they would kill her. And apparently her family said that she would be killed if she cooperated with the U.S. Is this still a process of sorting out exactly what was happening and what statements had to be made because it was a life or death situation?
Well, I think there's no question that there's going to be some confusion, and perhaps even, you know, Jill may make some confusing statements. You know, really at this point she shouldn't be talking to the press at all, and she was lied to by the Iraqi Islamic Party. That video she made for them, she was told, was purely for their internal records so that they would have evidence that they didn't have anything to do with it, and then they turned around and put it on TV. But there really isn't anything difficult to square here. She was threatened with death if she talked to or cooperated with the Americans. They told her that they had the Green Zone fully infiltrated and that they would wreak vengeance upon her if she spoke out. And right now she's been at the Green Zone, and she is working with investigators, and she's doing all those things that they told her they'd kill her for doing, because you know, now that she's free, she realizes that it's safe now, and that she's going to get home to her family safely.
Mm-hmm. Have you talked to her?
I have not, but I've spoken to all her family members, and Scott Peterson, who was sort of taking turns with me working on this in Baghdad, is there now, and he's seen her and spoken to her, and they all say that she's, of course, quite happy to be free.
We've read about this Stockholm syndrome, where folks who've been through an emotional ordeal like Jill has been through tend to sympathize with their captors. Do you think that's what happened here?
Well, you know, Stockholm syndrome, I have to be honest, makes my blood boil a little bit, because it's not, you know, it's not a very sophisticatedly understood in the public conscience. Yes, there is no doubt that Jill is incredibly emotionally fragile and confused, and I'm sure did everything she could to be friendly with her captors, because as the State Department tells its own people, that's the best single thing a hostage can do to ensure their ultimate survival. and all people that get into this situation or, you know, have pre-knowledge that this could happen to them are urged to take that approach. And she's a resourceful woman who I'm sure did everything she could to survive. But this notion that she's going to be some kind of Patty Hearst or that she's been brainwashed or, you know, that's just not the way it works in 99% of the cases. And I'm certain that isn't the case here.
Mm-hmm. I think it is difficult in a way for some folks following the story to say, well, what happened and why was she released? And there was talk about the demands of the group that was holding her. They wanted women prisoners released. Some were released quite some time ago. Was that demand fulfilled? I mean, I know that there are a lot of questions, but I think that folks sort of want to know, what's the story behind all of this?
Well, their demand was that all Iraqi women, both in American and in Iraqi custody in Iraq, be released. And of course, that never happened. There were some women released, but by no means all. And we think what happened here was simply that the overwhelming support of the Iraqi people, public service announcements that were carried for free in a number of local TV stations and in newspapers, you know, stressing exactly the sort of woman Jill is and her commitment to Iraq and the Iraqi people, essentially made it impossible for them to murder her or to keep her hostage indefinitely. They realized for their own propaganda reasons it was better to release her unharmed eventually than to do anything worse, because the outcry would have been so great.
Mm-hmm. At this point, then, do you know anything about this particular group? Are there any leads about exactly what might be happening with them or tracking them down and holding them accountable?
I hope they're tracked down and held accountable. We don't have any indications that anybody's close to getting them now. We could get lucky. They could get picked up someday. But quite frequently, people that kidnap and murder in Iraq, you know, get away with complete impunity.
Mm-hmm. So when might Jill Carroll come home?
She'll be with her family very soon, I've no doubt.
Dan Murphy is Arab World Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Today's Senate hearing on whether President Bush should be censured for his warrantless domestic wiretap program seemed like a scene from the movie Back to the Future, with senators calling witnesses from both the Nixon and Clinton administrations. Wisconsin Democrat Russ Feingold tapped former Nixon White House counsel John Dean to make the case for censuring the president. Dean said he was there to represent the view of the dark side, a reference to his involvement in the Watergate scandal, and he warned senators that presidents want Congress to stop paying attention to the White House.
There has been a growing tendency to let the president do what he wants and to have virtually no oversight. I can tell you from the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue, that's very important to presidents. They take note of that when they're not being called to the mat.
But Republican Orrin Hatch said now is not the right time to be debating censure.
Partisanship may be at a fever pitch around here these days, but wartime is not a time to take steps that may weaken the commander-in-chief.
Joining us with more on today's hearing is Gail Chadwick. She's congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Gail.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You say the hearings felt like a time warp. Why is that?
Well, to have John Dean back in front of a congressional panel for the first time since the Watergate years, being grilled by Lindsey Graham on, did President Nixon authorize a break-in? Did you authorize a break-in? the press were kind of spinning. It sounds like it's right back in that era. But what's so striking about this discussion? Because in a way, it is reworking the issues of that period. How much power can a president claim? But what was striking about Dean's testimony, and he's also said this in a recent book, he feels this is more serious than Watergate because this is a presidency that is trying to expand presidential power for the sake of expanding power. That's the sort of subtext of this whole discussion today.
Mm-hmm. Is that the main issue then, Gail? Is it the only issue? Are we going to go forward with this censure?
Oh, I think the censure is likely not going forward. If anyone will push it, it's the Republicans who want to use it as a campaign issue to show how far the Democrats are overreaching. But underneath this, there is a very serious issue over what kind of authority a president does have in a time of war. Unlike previous wars in this country's history, this one, the war on terror, is likely to go on for generations. And are we going to give presidents power to bypass laws for that whole period? This is a concern not just to Democrats, but to Republicans as well, especially the chairman, Arlen Specter.
Mm-hmm. If not censure, could something more milder go forward, do you think?
I would be very surprised. Because, you know, you can tell just by looking at the attendance at the hearing. The Democrats did not show up. You had Senator Leahy, Feingold, Senator Cole for kind of moral support from the same state. Only two Democrats have signed on to that censure resolution. This is something I think that they see as an obstacle rather than a strength at this point.
Mm-hmm. Because it could be viewed as something that they're doing, that they're overreaching because they're not waiting for the investigation into this program first.
That's right. And this is where the frustration for the Democrats came. There was one point where Senator Leahy just kind of turned red and said, "Now, how can you tell us that this program is justified or authorized? We don't know. The only people that do know, they've had 20 witnesses before the committee, four hearings in a month, but the only witness that actually knew was the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, and he refused to answer. So for Congress, who's trying to uphold their side of a balance of power, to not have basic information like how many Americans were tapped, was the information useful, how else can they get at some assessment of whether or not this is a broad dragnet overreaching or whether it's really needed to defend the country in a time of war?
Who besides John Dean is testifying, Gail?
Testifying today, you had... I think one of the most interesting to me is, what is his name? Fine, who was in the Reagan administration as well. He's been very outspoken, but also understands a conservative point of view and has been at this issue for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And why is he most interesting?
I think because his arguments are pretty persuasive. He is the one who's trying to lay out the case for what it is that the public has a right to know in a time of war and why Congress can't afford to just give the White House a pass on that, why they need to be much more specific in the kinds of questions they're asking.
Mm-hmm. What's also interesting, I think, at least politically...
Bruce Fine.
Okay. What's also interesting, at least from the political end of things here, is Senator Arlen Specter and his role here and what may or may not be happening with the Bush administration. One reporter described it as saying that the president may as well pull petals from a daisy if he's trying to determine where Arlen Specter stands these days in terms of his support. What's the role here of Specter? Is it changing?
Well, Specter has described the resolution as not frivolous, but without merit, which is kind of picking at daisies, I suppose. But he's very clear on what he wants to come out of this process. He wants a decision by the FISA court as to what the FISA law ought to be and whether or not the president has overstepped. He wants someone who's not going to leak to actually hear very detailed information as you would in a court of law, and he trusts the courts to resolve it.
All right, Gail, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to cut you off. Gail Chadha, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Jury deliberations continue in the penalty phase of the trial of admitted al-Qaeda conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui. The jury must decide whether Moussaoui is eligible for the death penalty. Yesterday, jurors asked for a definition of weapons of mass destruction. Moussaoui could be executed for conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction, and the judge told the jury a plane used as a missile qualifies. Greg Gordon is covering the trial for the Minneapolis Star Tribune newspaper. And Greg, remind us, where does the trial stand at this point?
We've just started the third day of deliberations. And so we're now, Wednesday and Thursday, they deliberated more than 8 hours, by my best guess.
And Moussaoui, let's just talk about the charges briefly as well. Moussaoui was in jail on 9/11 on immigration charges. But
correct.
Prosecutors say he may have been able to minimize, maybe even prevent the 9/11 attacks if he had revealed his al-Qaeda membership. And there's been some conflicting testimony about his response to that and his defense, yes?
Yes, and some of the conflicting testimony comes from Moussaoui himself. When he pleaded guilty about a year ago, he stood in the courtroom and said, September 11th, that was not my conspiracy. He essentially said that he was part of a broader plot to seize and crash U.S. jetliners into prominent buildings. So Monday, he comes into the court and takes the witness stand and says, no, I was going to fly a fifth plane into the White House as part of the September 11th operation. I didn't know the date, but I was part of that operation. And he also reiterated a line that he did admit to a year ago in saying, I lied so the operation, so my brothers in Al-Qaeda could go forward with this operation.
So it seems as if, A, you're trying to prove a hypothetical here, and then you've got conflicting and sometimes complicated testimony. So this seems like it's a very sort of tangled case, if you will.
The jurors basically have to decide whether they want to put somebody to death on a hypothetical, and the defense has introduced a mountain of evidence of government bureaucratic incompetence and interagency fighting and communication lapses that prevented investigators from following up on a number of other really good clues about September 11th, including the fact that two of the hijackers were already in the country in early 2000.
Is that what you think has struck you the most during these 3 weeks of testimony and these documents when you look at what the defense has presented in terms of these warnings and the huge bureaucracy that we have and sort of the infighting, the greed, the political protection and all of those kinds of things? Would you say that that is really the most striking?
It is striking, but I think another part of this case that's really confusing, I think, to most observers, is just to try to figure out what Moussaoui is up to here. You know, why is he changing his story? He supposedly had a meeting in early February at the jail with prosecutors and with one of his defense lawyers, in which he said, "I want to testify for the government." And when he sat down in the witness stand, his question and answer session with his own defense lawyer was very awkward and strained, and the defense lawyer was tiptoeing his way around trying to figure out what question was going to hurt the defense, was going to hurt Moussaoui. And when the prosecutor took over, Moussaoui was like an eager beaver. He was ready to answer all the questions. It was a very calm exchange, and the prosecutors, however, had to make a strategic decision. And they, when it came to the closing arguments, they seized on Moussaoui's latest confessions and said these are fact. And the jury now will have to decide whether one of the things they'll have to decide seems to be whether the prosecutor's credibility is hurt by the fact that they've accepted Moussaoui's assertions as fact when other captive Al Qaeda members who gave statements to interrogators at some unknown foreign sites, their statements basically said Moussaoui had no part of September 11th, was never involved in it. He was training for a second wave attack, and he didn't know anything about the September 11th strike.
We talked a little bit in the beginning about how it might be determined whether Moussaoui is eligible for the death penalty. Can you explain that a little bit?
He was arrested in the Twin Cities while learning how to fly a 747 jumbo jet, and he was hauled in on an immigration charge because he was out of status. And so he was questioned on the tips of a couple of program managers at this flight school in a Twin City suburb. They got very suspicious, and the FBI agent, Harry Sammet, pushed this thing over in the ensuing 3 weeks to the hilt, contending that Moussaoui was lying. So what the jury's going to have to decide is, was he intentionally lying to allow this operation to go forward? And then the second part of this deliberation has to revolve on what would the government have done and would the government have been able to save at least one life, which basically comes down to would they have been able to stop one of the four planes from being hijacked.
If the jury does decide in this phase that Moussaoui is eligible for the death penalty, then what?
Then we go to phase two, which is when the jury will weigh aggravating and mitigating factors. The government plans to bring in dozens of family members of September 11th victims, and these family members will describe the impact that this horrible loss has had on their lives. And the defense will then have to turn around and come in with Moussaoui's side of the story. They plan to bring in, I think it's a French sociologist who will talk about his turbulent upbringing and how he was easy prey for the radical fundamentalist mosques in London, where he went to attend college and didn't have very much money. And the mosques were feeding him, and he was sort of swung over ultimately to Al-Qaeda.
Greg Gordon's covering the death penalty trial of Zacharias Moussaoui for the Star Tribune newspaper. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With the federal No Child Left Behind Act in full swing in the nation's elementary and secondary schools, Congress and the U.S. Education Department are turning their attention to the standards at the country's colleges and universities. Yesterday, the House passed a bill that's been 3 years in the making. Supporters say it's designed to make higher education more affordable, and it requires more transparency from colleges and universities that significantly increase their fees. With annual costs at private schools in the $40,000 range, accountability is also an issue that the Education Department wants addressed. A new Commission on the Future of Higher Education is considering standardized testing of undergraduates as an option. Joining us on the line is Dr. Carl Moses. He's Deputy Provost for Academic Affairs at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. It's currently testing some undergraduates in an experimental program. Welcome, Dr. Moses.
Thank you.
Tell us about this pilot program. About 100 universities are participating in this test right now, and what is the test?
I understand that it's about 100 universities who are involved in working through the Collegiate Learning Assessment, which is an assessment of critical thinking and analytical reasoning skills for undergraduates.
Mm-hmm. And why did Lehigh want to be part of this program?
We are looking at assessment methods in general, just for our own purposes, but also because accreditation nowadays expects institutions to adopt assessment processes. And so we're looking for processes that work for us, and we wanted to try the Collegiate Learning Assessment to see if it would be a good tool for us to use.
Collegiate Learning Assessment sounds like it could be something very difficult because of the diversity of institutions in this country, their missions, all of those kinds of things. Why would this be happening right now, do you think, and how do you know that it would be effective?
Well, we don't know that it will be effective. We're trying it out. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the Collegiate Learning Assessment just looks at critical thinking and analytical reasoning. There are a whole host of other kinds of skills that you might hope a college education would impart, not to mention mastering a body of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Explain to me what the test is, basically.
Well, it's an interesting test in a way because it's not a standard, you know, bring your number two pencil and a good eraser and fill in some bubbles on a piece of paper. It requires the subject to provide authentic responses to prompts.
Can you give me an example of a question and what kind of response someone might
be? Well, an example of a critical thinking prompt would be, imagine that you're a campaign manager for a mayoral candidate in your town, and your candidate has been charged by his opponent with being soft on crime, and now you need to prepare a memorandum to get your candidate up to speed to answer that charge. And so then, you don't have to just make it up out of whole cloth. The student is provided with a library of information, newspaper articles, crime statistics, a whole host of information about crime and the social environment in your town, and you use all of that information to construct the memorandum for your candidate.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned accreditation at the beginning. I'm wondering, would you say then that accreditation didn't get into the specifics of student assessment up until this point? and so that's why this additional step might be necessary?
Right. Well, and in fact, even now, they expect an institution to have an assessment process, but they are not interested in telling us what that process ought to be. They give each institution the opportunity to build a process within that institution's own mission and goals.
Hmm. Oh, why is this being done right now?
Well, I think everybody's interested in accountability. I don't think that people in higher education are afraid of being held accountable. I think that the issue is to place it all in the context of student learning and the outcomes that matter at a given institution. I think that we are reminded frequently that really the whole world is watching. Everybody wants to know that the educational process is achieving some kinds of objectives. At the same time, we're sensitive and very much aware that there are some outcomes that can't be measured meaningfully. It's also true that student effort matters a whole lot. Have the students bought into the institution's mission and goals?
When you mention that everyone's interested in accountability, I get the feeling when I hear these stories that there's almost a feeling that perhaps the higher education system in this country is not as good as it could be, and that's why we need to sort of figure that out. Would you agree with that?
No, that's an interesting point. I just can't imagine that there's really any question that folks who get some kind of post-secondary education are better off in many ways than those who don't. So I think in a qualitative sense, that accountability question already has an answer. I think that getting a more quantitative answer to the accountability question is not an unreasonable goal for us to have in higher education, but there are lots of challenges, and I have trouble imagining one size fits all.
A lot of folks have mentioned this movement toward more accountability and standardized testing and compared it with the No Child Left Behind Act that's in place for elementary and secondary schools in the country. Do you think that it's a similar kind of a thing?
Actually, no, I don't. In fact, the comments that I've heard from the commission have indicated that perhaps they don't even see it the same way. There are a big difference between the K-12 type of educational experience that we expect and the accountabilities that we might have there and accountability in college. For one thing, students who go to college have self-selected themselves for college enrollment. We're hoping that there's some alignment between the individual student's goals and the institution's goals. And students at that sort of 19, 20-year-old age are passing through a stage in development in which they need to become actually more accountable themselves for their own learning. So really, one of our goals is to help students learn to learn. And that can happen in a wide range of settings and through a lot of different types of curricula. But being able to make adjustments to the changing world and changing circumstances in the workplace and community, those are important objectives for education, a college education in particular.
You mentioned the Education Department's Higher Education Commission. There's been some criticism of the commission for being chaired by a testing proponent and having corporate executives on board and no students. Do you think the commission, A, is going to be able to come up with a system where we can assess some of this and address accountability, and will they be able to do it in the time frame by which they've set, which is this fall, I think, having some sort of formal recommendations?
Well, I'm going to be skeptical about that. It's interesting to think about whether that's really the expectation that Secretary Spellings has for the commission, or that whether the commission is just intended to be one set of voices addressing the concerns in higher education.
Education Secretary Margaret Spellings.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
The time frame is tight. It would appear that perhaps there's an agenda operating within the commission, although there probably are some very open-minded people there as well. Will they come out and expect standardized testing? I'm going to vote my doubt that they will.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Moses, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Sure. My pleasure.
Dr. Carl Moses is Deputy Provost for Academic Affairs at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. You're listening to Here and Now. College basketball fans will be watching the final games of March Madness this weekend. The men are playing in Indianapolis. The women are in Boston. Last weekend, though, Boston hosted another competition between robots. Each one was built and programmed by high school students. More than 45 teams battled it out in a game that's a cross between basketball and soccer. Similar contests were held in cities across the country in the run-up to the final contest in what's called the First Robotics Competition, which will be held in Atlanta at the end of April. First Robotics was founded by inventor Dean Kamen and MIT professor Woody Flowers. Teams of students working with professional engineers or teachers build a robot from a standard kit, and the robot has to perform particular tasks. Here and Now producer Matt Largy caught up with one of the teams called TJ Squared from Bridgewater Raynham High School in Massachusetts.
I'm Liz Kayla, physics teacher at Bridgewater Raynham Regional High School and head coach of the TJ Squared First Robotics team. This is the ball pickup mechanism. It picks the balls up from the floor. The balls are like plastic-covered Nerf balls. They come right up the top, comes into the chute right here, and then it goes down to the shooter right here and onto those wheels, and then it shoots them out. So it shoots them into a basketball hoop.
I'm Rachel Amaral. I'm on the first robotics team called TJ Squared. Well, on each side, there's two big hoops, and next to them are two little, like, soccer net things. And there's three robots on each team. There's a red alliance and a blue alliance. And the goal is for the robots to shoot it into the big hoop, which, and you get 3 points for that, like a basketball three-pointer. And on the side goals, if you get them in, you get 1 point.
In the United States, a lot of people are afraid of engineering, and a lot of American students flunk out of engineering in the first year. And so what we're trying to do is get to kids in their high school years so that they take the courses that prepare them for a career in engineering.
We're queuing the robot. We're getting ready for the next match we're going into. All right. Now we're rolling the robot over to the playing field. All right, here we go.
Get her done.
Blue, are you guys ready? 3, 2, 1, go.
My name's Sarish Abid, and I'm operator for the team. I work the back rollers that pick up the balls. I work the shooter, and I turn the shooter to shoot. I have two control sticks, and one of them, when I push it forward, it starts the rollers from the back to move them up. If I push it backwards, they move the rollers backwards so I can bring my balls down. We're not allowed to have any sort of special mechanism created to, like, disrupt robots, but we sort of rely on ramming other robots to, like, disrupt their scoring.
From my point of view as a physics teacher, it gives students a hands-on opportunity to actually build something. We're inventing something right from ground zero. And at the end of a six-week period, the students see that we've made something that can do something.
All right, let's see if we can pump them in. Take your time.
In this program, they get to work side-by-side with practicing engineers. It's kind of like in football. You really like football when you see the pros play it. Well, we're thinking that they're really going to like science when they see the pros do it.
See if we can come up and around. Quick. Make a dash. Up. Go. Oh, yeah! Oh, yes, sir. Thank you. Oh, yeah.
That's the robotics team from Bridgewater Raynham High School in Massachusetts. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. New York officials today released nearly 9 hours of emergency calls from September 11th, some of them made by those trapped in the World Trade Center that day. The New York Times and some of the victims' relatives had sued for the tapes' release in the hopes that more details of what happened within the Twin Towers would be made clear. In trying to piece together a motive for the attack, several theories emerged, including one widely reported on the Internet that no Jewish people died at the World Trade Center. Filmmaker Mark Levin heard this repeated on the streets of New York City.
During the time of the World Trade Center, you've seen every funeral be covered for everybody. You've not seen one Jewish funeral covered on the media because no Jews died in the World Trade Center.
You mean to tell me, every single Jew in the World Trade Center knew about it beforehand and not one of them would have said anything? That because you were saying Jews.
We're not saying that. We're saying they didn't go to work. They didn't go to
work. That's a fact.
Levin found that many people backed up this belief by citing the book The Protocols of Zion, which alleges a Jewish plan to take over the world. Levin explores what appears to be a resurgence of anti-Semitism in the wake of 9/11 in his film titled The Protocols of Zion. It's being shown on Cinemax next month. We talked with Levin before the film's release, and he told us how it all began.
Only weeks after 9/11, I was in New York talking to lots of people, and one night I was in a car with a young Egyptian cab driver, and he starts repeating these rumors, you know, the Jews were warned, no Jews came to work, and then he tells me no Jews died. And I'm like, what, are you crazy? I get the New York Times right in my hand. They're already listing the missing and the presumed dead. And he says to me, it was all written 100 years ago in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. I have to be honest with you, I first read it in the 70s during Watergate. Someone said, here, you're interested in conspiracies, here's the original conspiracy theory. I read it as an artifact of a time long gone, as a document that had been thrown on the garbage heap of history. If anybody had ever told me this thing is going to resurface in the 21st century, I'd say you're out of your mind.
And you can get copies of it today.
Absolutely. It's sold on the streets of New York, which is where I started my film. It's sold on the web. It's been turned into a television series in the Arab world.
Well, why do they keep resurfacing?
Well, that's the question that my film asks. And what I did is not a history of the protocols, but looking at these rumors around 9/11. Why do people believe this stuff? I would say there are a variety of answers. One, when something so shocking and traumatic happens, like 9/11, that just changes the paradigm, changes history. You can't ignore that for 2,000 years in Western culture, the Christian and Jewish struggle, and that for at least 1,700 years, it was accepted as church doctrine that they should be punished and persecuted as the killers of Christ. And then the Arab-Israeli conflict, you can't ignore that either, that has obviously stirred up so much hate and resentment. And now, with the United States involved in Afghanistan, our troops in Iraq, you've got another element. So all of these mix together, and you go to this default theory, something crazy happened, blame the Jews.
And so you take this question and you say, okay, why is this rumor persisting after all this time and all of this debunking? And you bring it to scholar Leonard Zipperin, yes, or Lionel Zipperin, rather, and he tells you, don't go near it. Let's hear his warning. We do have a clip from the film right now.
The rabbis warned the Jews all through history, don't take on the powers that be in their religio-ideological disputes. You will say things that will provoke people and you will bring bloodshed on the Jewish community. Then they come into the ghetto the next day, rape the women, smash everything, burn it. They're that angry. So don't do it.
You didn't listen.
I didn't listen, and, you know, I'll be honest with you that although I've gotten tremendous support from the Jewish American community, there are Jewish Americans who are uncomfortable about talking about Jewish conspiracies, Jew hatred, the protocols. They feel no matter how well-intentioned it is, ultimately, it's going to backfire.
Well, that's what I wondered watching it. I mean, don't you worry that you're giving some sort of validity to them by paying attention to them in a film?
Obviously, I've thought a lot about that. I want to acknowledge that people feel this way and certainly respect them. I do disagree. I'd say two major things. One, first of all, I believe light is the great disinfectant. Better to hold this thing open and talk about it openly than to hide it under the table where it gains even more power and myth. Two, that worldview, which was the Jewish diaspora view for a good 1,600 years, we don't live in that world anymore. The Jews have done tremendous in the last 50 years in the United States and Canada. And the idea that talking about this or giving the microphone to haters is going to amplify their hate, what I would say to that is, when I saw the diaspora, which is the television series that was shown during Ramadan to tens of millions of Muslims around the world, which is basically a dramatization of the protocols, I had to ask myself, exactly who are we hiding this from?
You also have your dad in the film, and you talk about your own personal story. Why did you decide to do it that way?
That was the last thing added to the film. I had shown a cut, like a, what we call a three-hour assembly, two friends, and they all said, it's too much. It's an overdose of hate. You can't digest it. You need other emotions in the story so you can go up and down and you have time to kind of assimilate this. And I thought about that over the weekend, and I had shot stuff with my father that, quite honestly, I was just doing for my own family, you know, to just have my father, who was almost 80, still on his game, just to save some of that for the family. And my editor came in, and he put some of that together. And when I looked at it, I said, wow, well, this is interesting. Here you see the love of a father and son. You see family. You see a heritage, a whole other range of emotions as people had been asking for. So that was the last thing added to the film.
Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the film, we go back to 9/11. And we're going to hear a clip here as well, a scene with Shia Rabowski of the Medical Examiner's Office in New York when he addresses the claim that no Jews died in the World Trade Center.
Jews were killed in September 11th. Hundreds and hundreds of Jews were killed. I spoke to their families. I went to memorial services, and I went to the grave of a very good friend of mine, who was the assistant cantor of our synagogue, Jeffrey Wiener, who was a Jew and who was killed.
So we hear. We hear from folks on the ground, and we all have read the New York Times shortly after 9/11 has happened, and yet it persisted. You've done your film. Does it persist still?
It will persist. My personal experience is that promoting dialogue, no, it's not about conversion. You know, just somebody saying, I've seen the lights, I love Israel, I love the Jews. It's conversation. But conversation can make a difference, especially if the tone and the dynamics and the atmospherics of that conversation change.
Is the idea of bias against the Jews, is it worse or has it improved?
Historically improved. At the same time, since 9/11, there's no doubt that around the world there has been a resurgence of anti-Jewish sentiment. But let me just say that in the end, I'm not saying that the Gestapo is coming. My fear, quite frankly, is think about it like this. Fanatics of all faiths, not just Islam, believe that their hate is holy, that their violence is sacred, and if you don't agree with their divine insights, you are expendable. How do you fight that? That's the big question on the table. And I hope if this film can add to that discussion and get people talking about it in a new, fresh way, that'll be a step forward.
Mark Levin's film is The Protocols of Zion. It'll be shown on Cinemax next month. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.